On Tuesday, April 20th, from 2 to 4 a.m., Sugar in My Bowl will focus on jazz legend Pharoah Sanders, who is highly regarded to the point of reverence by many jazz fans. That's Tuesday, April 20th, from 2 to 4 a.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. That was Night Shift with Mike Sargent. No Byron this week. And what's your name? I'm sorry. Elena. Elena. The lovely Elena. Stay tuned for Sugar in My Bowl. You can hear Night Shift next week at midnight. And let's see. Here we go.
I want a little sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving, oh, so bad. I feel so funny, I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl. So they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar.
Right. Sugar in My Bowl, that's what you're listening to right now on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. My name's Joyce Jones, and we'll be listening to a conversation. I got something going on here, yeah. A conversation with Pharoah Sanders between myself and Hank Williams, my special co-host. We recorded this when Pharoah Sanders was in town for his Birdland gig, which was after the celebration in Brooklyn as part of the Central Brooklyn Jazz Consortium. So stay tuned. Let's get started right about now.
I guess to get started, by way of background, can you talk a little bit about what it was like for you growing up in Little Rock at that time and what the music scene was like there?
Oh, no. See, like when I was coming, there wasn't no hope. In the town in North Little Rock, Arkansas, southern place, you know, they make that much money, you know, and only way you could really get into this music back in Arkansas was like when you went to church or something, you know, and you sang in a choir. I did that a little bit, but maybe a few months or something, and I didn't come to the rehearsals, so I wasn't in it anymore. So because I was always faithful to church. The first one to go to church, be there on time every Sunday. My family, very religious type of family, you know. And, it was very quiet, you know. We had dinner, and then we finished, come out on the front porch, there was a swing, you know. Mm-hmm. And I sit on the steps, and we sit out there, and me and my mother and father, and nobody said anything for hours. I was the only child, so my childhood days were sort of lonely. I always loved when somebody come over to the house. It didn't matter who. There wasn't a lot of things happening, you know. I always wanted to be a painter. I used to draw all the time.
Really?
You know, that was my whole thing.
Do you still do that?
Well, I haven't did anything in a long time because I got this music and I practice it every day.
Was there music that you listened to on the radio?
There was a station called KOKY. I remember that station. They had jazz part of the day because at that time it was more like rhythm and blues bands, you know. And some of the rhythm and blues band, you know, they were very good. You know, they could play jazz too. Plus you had the blues bands also. So that was another kind of thing. That's how I made my money when I was going to high school, playing on the weekend. Some of the local blues players, they used to come and get me in. Asked me would I work for 10 cents, 5 cents, $10, 5, you know, whatever. My mother got mad at them because they would tell me $10, and then I finished, they give me $5. But I wasn't even thinking about money. I was just want to blow the horn.
Just wanted the opportunity to play.
Yeah, my mother, them, they didn't really like it. You know, you going to go play for them again? I said, well, yeah, I want to play. I'm just learning, you know, this is a, you know, experience for me. You know, so whenever they left home going somewhere, I would sneak in the living room and find some records and play them. Some of Decca records, some other labor also. But I learned a lot of songs from listening to those records. You know, because I would never go to the dance and, you know, where kids go dance and all that. You know, I stay home, listen to the radio, and get my horn out. I couldn't blow my horn, but I got it out and finger, you know. And that's the only time I could really hear this music. It was on the radio. I couldn't play it at home because we didn't have those kind of records at home. We had like B.B. King and some other. I learned a lot from just listening, you know.
round of applause to welcome the world's greatest blues singer, the king of the blues, B.B. King! Every day I have the blues. Every day. Every day I have the blues. When you see me wearing woman, and it's you I hate to lose. Nobody loves me. Nobody seems to care. Yes, nobody loves me. Nobody seems to care. Making up worries and trouble, darling. You know I've had my share.
Time that I had to really learn about the elements, you know, of this music. You know, I didn't know it wasn't about a talent. You can have talent, but you got to learn a whole lot of other things, you know. And it caused me to, okay, that's where it's gonna be. Then that's what I do. My band teacher, he could play, you know. I got a lot from being around him. He was talking about, you know, all those jazz musicians. They just travel and practice all day long, all night long. They don't do nothing. And I said, oh. And I remember my father heard me said it to one of my friends outdoor. I told my friend, when I get grown, I'm not carry anything heavier than my instrument. He got a little strange and. But he didn't really understand me at the time because I really wanted to play a horn at that time.
So when you were playing with the school band, were you playing clarinet or?
I was playing clarinet. Oh. You know, but I was the kind of person I was cut class. I never went to my English class too tough, you know. But I was there when they had the test and I passed the test. She used to tell me, like, direct to my face, if you ever want to come to my class, please do. You know, I know you love this music, but you got to come to my class. I go up there and I listen to my band teacher play, and we go over certain songs. Then I would try other instruments. I was up there trying to play the trumpet, trying to play the accordion, and trying to play the bass tuba. They didn't stop me. I wanted to find out everything possible I can find. Maybe reed instrument is not my instrument. I used to use the school horn to make the jobs because I didn't have a saxophone, and it wasn't in too good a shape. The school instruments, they don't fix those instruments. Key be falling off, you know, and still they don't fix it. My school was more interested into sports. rather than anything else. So,
unfortunately, that's still somewhat true.
Yeah, very little money coming out to buy instruments, band uniforms. Yeah, I was one of them kind of guys marching on the football field, marching and doing all that. I used to play drums and play the cymbals. I was out there clowning, what do you want to you know, and the cymbal all behind my back, or, you know, doing all that. But then I finally found out what I really wanted to do, and that was play the clarinet. So, like I had bought this metal clarinet for about $17. $0.50.
Which was a fair amount of money at that point.
Yeah, for me to make $17, I don't have a dime. I don't have a nickel penny. But I saved 20 cent every, maybe once a week I saved 20 cent. And I gave the guy at church 20 cent every Sunday. And he was the owner of the instrument. And he's a very nice person, you know. He turned out to be a minister. And he told me, I can have this horn. You can have it for $17.50, and I don't know why he came across that figure, but that's what it was, you know. And I was so happy when I got the horn, you know. I couldn't play it too well, but I learned on my own. I started playing, practicing, and came to a point where I practiced so much I got even ahead of the class.
Listening to Sugar in My Bowl, and you're still listening to Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones, and we are listening to a conversation that I and my special co-host Hank Williams had with Farrell Saunders. As a matter of fact, we went to his hotel when he was in New York last week at Birdland. Just to let you know what you've been hearing, what we're listening to right now is You've Got to Have Freedom. That's this is composed and arranged by Farrell Saunders from Journey to the One. It's a 1992 Evidence Music release. Farrell Saunders on tenor sax, Eddie Henderson on flugelhorn, John Hicks on piano, Idris Muhammad on drums, Ray Drummond on bass, Vicky Randall, Go Spencer, Donna D.D. Dickerson, and Bobby McFerrin on vocals. That's right, Bobby McFerrin. Before that, we heard Every Day I Have the Blues, B.B. King. It's from B.B. King's Greatest Hits, originally recorded in November of 1964, released in 1965, on live at the Regal, which the Regal Theater is in Chicago. This is from a 1998 MCA Records compilation. Kenneth Sands on trumpet, Duke Jethro on piano, Johnny Board, and Bobby Forte on tenor sax, Leo Launch on bass, and Sonny Freeman on drums. Before that, we heard April in Paris, the Count Basie Orchestra. Count Basie and Friends, originally recorded, this particular recording was originally recorded in 1962 on Basie in Sweden. This is from a 2004 Roulette Jazz compilation, which includes Thad Jones on trumpet, Benny Powell on trombone, among other people, Charlie Foulkes on baritone sax, Freddie Green on guitar, Louis Belson on drums, and Count Basie on piano. Before that, we heard the opening, the theme for Sugar in My Bowl. I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl. It's from Nina Simone. The very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. Originally recorded in 1967, this is from a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl, and You Gotta Have Freedom. Yeah.
I was the student band director of the band. So we really wanted the band to be a good band and to read well. And because other two, they had like good bands and good like clarinet players. So I had to help the clarinet players to really to practice some. And if let's go home. We can go home after school and let's get together and run over some of the music, you know, because they wouldn't practice. You know, I'm ready to move on to another school. But they started practicing. They got a little better, you know. And the band teacher, and Mr. Jimmy Cannon, he was fussy. He didn't really play at all with nobody. Once he put his baton up like that, nobody should be talking to anything. And I've seen him throw that thing at quite a few people, you know. He, shut up. And I raise it like this, I want to hear a pin fall. So he was going at it that way, you know, and it made me got more serious about what I was doing, you know.
When you decided to move to Oakland, I know you had relatives up there. Mm-hmm. Was that primarily the reason?
I don't know. That was a way for me getting out of the South.
Right.
First of all, yeah, I had lots of relatives like in Oakland and Frisco. It worked out pretty well. You know.
So what was music like in Oakland?
It was some guys that was playing. It was really, really playing, you know. And I met one piano player named Bob Caillou, and he had a group tenor player, and his brother played bass and a drummer. They really sound great. They remind me of the Miles Davis quintet, you know. And Bob Caillou, the piano player, you know, he heard me playing one time, or either practicing. So he said, "Hey, man, you sound good, man. You know, why don't you come out and play?" You know. And so I said, "Okay." I started playing with him, you know. At one point, and he saw all the work that I needed accomplish, you know. And so I said, "Well," and so he told me, he asked me, "Do you know anything about chord changes?" I said, "Chord changes?" I said, "I never heard of them." So he told me about what I should really practice on, and learn all my skills. And when I learned all my skills, then come back to him. He would help me with my chord changes, and then I started getting to the piano to play my chords, you know. So he helped me with that also. He gave me just the basics, and from that point on, I could figure out the rest of it, you know, because I was in it every day. And if you didn't know your scales, you could, you know, unless you got a good ear, you know, that tells you what to do, the chord changes. And the chord changes is like a tonality of many scales. So if you got your scales together, you got your chords together. You just have to know how to construct the notes, you know. But this music's not easy.
No.
It's not easy at all. You might think it is, you know, somebody else playing, but I'm listening to everybody, you know, see what they're doing, you know. But, I met people like Sonny Simmons. There was some great musicians around in the area at that time. Also, Dewey Redmond, a tenor player. I don't know, you might know of him.
We'll be right back.
living in Frisco. So when I used to go to Frisco and listen to the guys, you know, do the little sessions around town, you know, there was a lot of those little clubs. They had a little jazz here, a little jazz there, you know. They opened up some different times, you know. Heard, you know, lots of, you know, local guys playing, you know. That's how I got that name. You know, they called me Rock because I was from Little Rock.
Oh.
They never knew my real name. Nobody never knew my real name until I did an album when I came to New York City. I did something with John Coltrane, and they saw my picture and said, "That's Rock. That's not Fredo Sanders. Who is that? That's Rock." And they called me. Some of them called me Rock. Some called me Little Rock. And one time, John Coltrane asked me. He said, "Man, what is your name? I've been hearing a Little Rock. What is your name?"
Actually, we want to talk about your playing with John Coltrane. But before we go there, Sun Ra.
I didn't want my parents to know I was living like this, you know. Especially when I came to New York City, I definitely didn't. I didn't let nobody know where I was, my mother, anybody. They was all worried about me, you know. So I hitchhiked a ride here to New York. That's how I got here. There was a Spanish guy coming to New York. He wanted to come to New York City, so I asked him, "Can I come along?" You know, I had like a suitcase full of clothes, and all my clothes that was dirty. I still had to bring it, and I brought my horn. It was one of those old horn cases. Oh, it was heavy. You know.
You were playing sax by this time, or still clarinet?
Well, I gave up my clarinet. In Oakland, because you know, I was trying to buy a new Selma. I always wanted a new Selma. I used to see pictures like in the book, and I know they cost a lot of money. At that time, it was going for about $500 somewhere along in there. That was about 1959, and I saw this Selma like in a store at one time, and it wasn't new. It was old one, a balance action. And so the guy gave me the price of it, you know. I wanted it, you know, but the way I got it, you know, I guess the down payment or whatever. I had five instruments when I came to Oakland. Or maybe I just had four instruments. You know, I traded them all in for this horn, you know, and I got it, you know. And but then again, here come the like the monthly payments. So I had to ask my uncle, would he co-sign for me so I could get this instrument? So he was kind of strange, you know. He called my mother and all this stuff, you know. It's my mother's brother, you know. So because I was trying to go to school, I was going to school, and I had to quit school because of that, you know, and work a job. You know. It was still a music job, but finally I got the horn, you know. It was all paid off, and I was happy. So.
Now, this was a tenor? Tenor sax. Right. So you and your tenor sax came to New York.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was scared. I didn't know anything about New York City. The only thing I know, everybody said to me, "Yeah, man, your sound, man, is not like around here. You need to go to New York City. See, because you're more serious. You got guys around here, all they want to do is smoke and drink beer, go to a park and drink ale and drink wine, all this kind of stuff."
So what were your gigs like in New York and before you met Sun Ra?
I wasn't working.
Oh,
when I met Sun Ra, I wasn't working at all. You know, I was living up underneath an outgoing apartment building and sleep up on the staircase on the first floor. You know, and it was because I had no money. I had no place to stay. I just wanted to hitchhike to New York City.
Right, right.
They said that's the place for the music.
Right.
So that's where I went.
Right.
You know, so I came to New York, and I was hanging out down in the village. I was right there on MacDougal Street, Bleecker Street,
wow,
right in that area, you know. And I would be down there every day. And then somebody told me about this place on 42nd Street. And I saw this blood bank, this place where you can give blood,
right.
get like $5.
Right.
So I did that many times. So, you know, I went and did that a couple of times, you know. And then one time I checked into the men's Y, And it was $1.75 a night at that time at the Y, you know. So I stayed there one night, and I had my clothes in there, and so I could take me a shower and everything and all that, but I had no clean clothes. But I was I went on to take my shower. So I went out. I think I might have went to a movie. You know, I was up there. I stayed up there all day long, saying the same thing all over again, you know, until nightfall, you know. So I went back to the Y, and I went to my room. The door was locked. And I said, oh, let's have my clothes again. Let's, you know, it's New York strange at that time, you know. And so I went to the front desk. And they told me I had to pay again. So I said, oh, you know. But then again, I turned around. I saw my things down in the lobby. They had put my stuff out, took it all out. But I always kept my horn with me everywhere I went to, like the theater, like the movies, whatever. And I always had my horn with me because I don't want to lose my horn. That's the reason why I came here.
Listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. This is Sugar in My Bowl, and we're having a conversation with Farrell Sanders, me, Joyce Jones, and Hank Williams, my special co-host. And right now we're listening to Sun Ra, The World Shadow. Is that the one? Yes, The World Shadow, and this is from Sun Ra featuring Farrell Sanders and Black Harold. This was released in, it was actually released in 2009. It was originally recorded in 1964. This is the only recording that Farrell Sanders did with Sun Ra. It was from a Jazz Composers Guild 4 days in December at Judson Hall in New York. In December, on New Year's Eve, 1964. We have Farrell Sanders on tenor sax, which I'm talking over right now. Black Harold, Harold Murray on other recordings, flute, log drums, Al Evans on trumpet, Ted Nance on trombone, Marshall Allen, alto sax, Pat Patrick on baritone sax, Alan Silva, Ronnie Boykins on bass, Cliff Jarvis, Jimmy Johnson on drums, Art Jenkins on space voice, and actually, let's come back to this, because we need to hear from Sanders right now. This is Sugar in My Bowl. Stay tuned.
We'll be right back.
So how did you get the job at the club where Sun Ra?
I was on the street, and I met a lot of great musicians over that way. I met Billy Higgins, drummer, mm-hmm. and I met Sonny Red. I met John Hicks, pianist. I met C Sharp and China, his wife, and they was having a hard time. It didn't bother me. I had got another place, cost maybe about a little bit more than about $0.75. I had it for a week, you know, some kind of way, and because I keep giving this blood up so I can make some money, you know. And, but anyway, they was having a hard time, so I told them they can have my place, you know, take it. And I went and got me a pizza. At that time, it was like 15 cent a slice or something. And then I tried to get me one of those butternut bars. Mm. It cost a nickel. But the guy said, sir, it'd be 6 cents. I didn't have a penny, so he didn't give me the kid. So, you know, I didn't let things bother me at the time. I just knew that what I had to do, you know. But I always went somewhere so I could lean on my horn case and sleep a little bit, you know. And after a while, I was still making money off this blood thing, you know. I got on the subway. I didn't know where I was going all night long until daylight came up, you know. But I was still holding my horn, you know. I kept my horn together. Nobody stole my horn. I had. You were talking about Sun Ra. At the time when I met Sun Ra, I was working down in the basement of the place where he was working. And I was a cook, whatever you want to call it, chef, whatever you want to call it. I never cooked too much in my life, you know. Everything is frozen. You had a deep fryer thing, you know, oil and all this stuff, you know, dip it in there, you know, and it's ready and all that. I made coffee espressos. I made malts, milkshakes, all this stuff. And I heard this band upstairs playing, you know, and that was Sun Ra. And that's how I met Sun Ra. I went up the stairs and I heard this band, man. I never heard anything like that before, you know, and on the intermission, I told one guy I saw playing, I said, hey man, you know, I played tenor. If you need another tenor player, I'm working downstairs, you know. And so, they took me to meet Sun Ra, and Sun Ra was so funny. I said, how you doing, Sun Ra? Because he gave me his name. They told me his name, you know. And so Sun Ra looked at me and said, I'm the devil. he scared me. Sun Ra scared me. I was very serious. I just took it like, you know, if you need a tenor player, you know, I'd be available. You know, that's how. And at the same time, I met some other musician. It seemed like that was a place where a musician kind of like hung out. That was kind of maybe like strung out or something, what you want to call it, or wasn't doing too well or whatever. Then Sun Ra asked me would I work on the door, and so I had told him, sure, you know, he had a cigar box. And I remember they was charging $1.50 to come in. I remember that. I didn't know at that time how I was going to be making it around here in New York, you know, so I got a job walking down the street. Cat asked me, are you a musician? You want to work tonight? I said, yeah. It was an Italian place down in the village, right on 3rd Street. That was a place. It was like a private club or something. Anyway, when I went in there, I saw women. They was tall, like they was about 6'10". All of them, like, they had on these red things and shorts on and long stocking high heel shoes on. I never seen women that tall before, you know. And so the guy, I'm just looking. I'm dirty and everything. The guy took me in the dressing room. Say you don't even worry about nothing. Come on. So I went in the dressing room. They had these shirts. They had a towel already on it. You know, you just put it on, you know, and got the jacket and the pants. It was like a, you know, tuxedo.
Right.
And I didn't wear the shoes because we wear nobody's shoes. You know, they were shiny, but I didn't wear them. So I went to the gig. I didn't play my sax. I was playing piano on this gig. So the guy that was playing with me, he played drums. I'm not a piano player, but I was playing some chord changes and stuff. You know, well, it worked. I got my $10. That was a lot of money for me. Even if I got a quarter, at least I can buy a slice of pizza.
Certainly paid a lot more than the blood.
I didn't know these things are going to last any longer. You know, I'm trying to make it, you know.
Okay, let me say this. You're listening to Consequences. Consequences by John Coltrane. From Meditation, originally recorded in November 1965. This is a 1996 Impulse recording. John Coltrane, left channel, and Pharoah Sanders, right channel, tenor sax. McCoy Tyner on piano. Jimmy Garrison on bass. Rashid Ali drums on the left channel. And Elvin Jones on drums in the right channel. This was engineered by Rudy Van Gelder, the ever-great Rudy Van Gelder. Oh, yeah. And before that, we heard Sun Ra, as I mentioned, The World Shadow from Sun Ra featuring Pharoah Sanders and Black Harold. It's a 2009 ESP disc release. Before that, we heard Walls, Bridges. That was by Dewey Redman. Ear of the Behearer. I love that title. Ear of the Behearer. It's released in 1973. Impulse label. Dewey Redman, tenor sax. Ted Daniel on trumpet. Jane Robertson on cello. And Cerrone on bass. Eddie Moore on drums. Back to John Coltrane. Consequences from Meditation. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl. You can give me a call if you're still awake in 212-209-2900. We can chat a little bit. Stay tuned. Or, yes, you can email me at sugarinmybowl@gmail.com if you missed one of these titles. sugarinmybowl@gmail.com. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. WBAI, New York.
From Bleecker, there was a place called a Speakeasy Club. And I started working in there, you know. I didn't know any musician. I met an alto player named T. Sharp. I didn't know he was so great until later on. And he's one that really kind of helped me out also. But I got the job, though. And I just hired him to play with me. And then plus his wife, the same. I remember using a bass player named Wilbert Ware from my Chicago. And Wilbert Ware, and I had Billy Higgins on drums. And then I had John Hicks on piano. And that was it. I had the best rhythm section. And at the same time, there was another place around the corner called the Village Gate. And was that Thompson or something like that?
Yeah.
And they had lots of things happen there, you know, every night almost, or even on a weekend or something. And at the time, Bill Cosby would come into the club, you know, he was just getting started, and, you know, he always had his gym clothes on, white sneakers, all this stuff, you know. And so he came by the club one time, and he wanted to sit in and play drums. You know, I let him play drums, you know. Much he was doing, well, he was hitting at it. You know, I ain't gonna say it, you know. Then later on the weekend, here come Eric Dolphy and John Coltrane, and I'm on a bandstand playing. I'm doing Pharoah Sanders. I'm doing my thing and playing whatever I'm doing, you know. And then I happened to look, by the door, and I saw John Coltrane and Eric Dolphy. They were sitting beside each other. And they all sitting like this,
their arms crossed.
You know, and I looked over there and I saw John. Scared me. I said, they made me almost like stop playing. It was so powerful. I said, John, Coach, what they doing here for? I said, my goodness. I had met John once before in San Francisco, and I knew how he looked and all that, you know. So but he came up to the band and he said, yeah, that mouthpiece sounds good. It's got a deep chamber. I can really hear it, you know. You know, and I was saying, well, I guess it does. You know, I don't know anything about what he was saying too much, but it got a deep chamber. You know, it was just a mouthpiece to me at the time, you know. And then after that, I couldn't even play the rest of the night when that happened. you know how musicians are like this. When they hear you playing, they be checking you out to see how much you know, how much intellect you know about this music. They can check you out very, very close. You know, they kept playing the wrong notes, playing the wrong changes. You know, but they didn't do that kind of thing to me. You know, I knew tunes I didn't know. I knew I wasn't playing the right changes, but I had a good ear, so that kept me into the tonality of the tune. If a tune is in F, I would stay in F and solo, rather than trying to play the chord changes. You have to know the melody. Always keep the melody in your head. Remember the melody.
So at what point did you wind up playing with Coltrane after he visited your performance?
Maybe about another couple of years, because I was still on the street. I didn't let nobody know my situation, you know.
Had you already left Sun Ra Group?
I haven't met him officially. I met him when I was working there.
Right.
But after that, you know, I got because I left the restaurant at the time, so that just wasn't happening.
Okay.
You know, it wouldn't happen because the guy didn't want to pay me. Uh-huh. He just wanted me to work, but no pay.
Mm-hmm.
But I went on 8 anyway, free. When he wasn't there, I just put me to fish or something, ate anyway, and you know, had me a malt, you know.
Did you ever eventually wind up staying in the house that Sun Ra had, that they had up here in New York?
He was staying on 3rd Street between 1st and 2nd, 3rd Avenue at the time, and I remember going to his house one time and I was went over some of his music, you know, for a little while. Then after a while, you know, I didn't go over there. Then another time, I went by his house and summer I was making brown rice and like salmon. And he was mixing it all up, and he asked me, "Do I want some of it?" You know, I looked at it. I said, "Yeah, take a little bowl." And then I asked him, "Could I stay here tonight?" It seemed like he was a good person. So he told me, "I don't have no more beds. You know, you have to sleep on the floor." So I got a chair and just sit in the chair. It's about almost morning time when the sun came up, almost. And then all of a sudden, the ceiling came down.
Oh, no.
I heard something crack. And I ran. I just made it. You know, the whole ceiling just came down. And then, you know, then after this, when we talked, me and Sandra, you know, he wanted me to work with him, you know. So I said, okay. So I said, well, I got me a job now. So I started working with Sandra for the first time. And after the gig was all over, you know, and everybody almost had just like left, maybe, you know. And I was still waiting around for somebody to give me some money.
Right.
So I had to go to Sunrod and I said, well, do I get any kind of money? Do I get paid? And then he told me, well, only somebody I can pay was like John Gilmore and Marshall Allen. Those two, I don't have no money, you know. I said, oh, okay. Well, you know, I took it. I'm cool. And then I kind of feel like maybe I better keep on moving to another, like, different direction. Because I wasn't getting paid, you know, so I can't keep on doing this. Because I would, I would go with him and just, like, rehearse with him. But, you know, I don't think he was a person that wouldn't pay you. They weren't, you know, at that time, they weren't making no money. Cause they were playing in a place like Coffee House and
right.
Little small joints, you know, they have tea. They don't have no food, just teas and they making money off the door, so nothing I can say.
Were you with the orchestra there?
Not too long, just maybe that first job. Then I didn't go back.
The Sun Ra practices were somewhat legendary. What was that like for you? And was it difficult to adapt to what they wanted you to do?
We had some hard music. Sun Ra write some hard music. You have to really. But he'd make you study, you know, you see that music on paper, you know, and say, have to look at it for a minute, you know. That's okay, Sonny, you know. He had a different kind of rhythm section and all that, you know, but you had to keep on doing what you're doing. Don't worry about the other guys. They're doing something entirely different. You know, Sun Ra was the impossible. You know, you never know what he wants.
Question is how it came about and what the composition of it was.
Have
you ever played it again?
Strange, I haven't played it since I recorded it.
That's what I thought was part of the reason why I was asking.
A lot of my songs, I don't ever play them again, all these years, I never played all those first Empire stuff, Tahir, or
right.
A lot of things, you know. I never felt like it was such a great music, you know, so yeah. I never, a lot of my stuff is not so intellectual as other people would like. So I just kind of left it, you know, that's the way it was. You know. But I never have thought about playing like in person. I used to, in a place called Slugs, I did something, and I had Leon Thomas down there. I did, but after he kind of got his own band together, then I don't play those songs anymore.
It seems particularly that one would be difficult. Would be difficult to do when you have a 37-minute free jam that just gets recorded.
Well, I'm sure I play it, you know, but I just haven't taught my piano player the song, you know. Worked out right for the time.
Was that a live in studio performance? Was it?
It was just done like in studio. I was playing it before I came here. I thought about maybe my piano player should learn it anyway, you know. I mean, one time I went to Los Angeles and had a job out there at a place called the Lighthouse in Hermoso Beach. And I was walking somewhere and a couple of little white girls were saying, I've been listening to you for a long time. Why you put out an album called Black Unity? I said, well, that's the way I felt. You know, I don't have anything to do with nothing else. I don't have anything to do with anybody white. It just reminds me, I'm just thinking about the neighborhood that I was raised up in. So I said, Black Unity. And I was trying to find a name for the album. So I said, okay, I'll name it Black Unity. And that'll be it. I ain't going to change it at all. I'm not going to think further about it. That's it.
Black Unity was on the Impulse label. Mm-hmm. And it seemed as though that period was very experimental for you. You were able to really explore when you were on the Impulse label. Was that, as you remember?
Well, at the time, you know, it seemed like listeners, young listeners, you know, they was really open for something new, something different. Sun Ra worked very well at that time in this kind of music, you know. And they was creating a whole lot of different things, you know. They had lots of rhythms going on. And I've always felt like that needed to be done in some other rhythm section in music, you know. Need to add more rhythms, more drums. I can always use more drums, different rhythms, you know. With like Sun Ra Band, was so different because each player that played the instrument, when they wasn't playing, they had something to play some rhythms on, you know, or something they had, you know. And I always liked it. I said, oh, that's great, you know. And they keep the guys from focus on something else out here, you know. You know, some musicians be looking at women in the audience and looking at somebody else and all this kind of stuff, you know. Who knows what they're looking at, you know. But when you really into the music, you know, you can find something else to do besides putting your horn down and standing in the corner or something, or sitting down.
Right.
Some I kept you working, kept you busy doing something, you know. And I really liked that, you know. It seemed like, you know, they got all inside. They got the most out of what they was doing, you know. At one point, they were just playing just themselves. It wasn't about the music. They were just playing whatever they wanted to play, because it wasn't any kind of structure where they had to play with chord changes or something like that. They like create their own way of playing or whatever, you know. When I listen to Marshall Allen play, you know, he playing the alto, the way he plays the alto sound like he's playing the bass fiddle. I'm looking at it, I said, but the music coming out, the sound and everything coming out, I said, okay. I said, I haven't heard that before, you know. And I remember that like John really liked Sun Ra's music. He really liked what they was doing. And sometimes something about Sun Ra reminds me of John Coltrane, or maybe John Coltrane may remind me of Sun Ra or something. They had some, I don't know what it was, you know, but when I see Sun Ra, I think of John. I suppose sometimes, I don't know, maybe it's the eyes or the look, certain look or something, they was always very sort of warm towards me, you know. And it just reminded me of kind of people that I would like to meet, that type of men, you know.
All right. Time for me to tell you what you've been listening to. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM, Sugar My Bowl. What you're listening to right now in the background is Bluesin' for John C. This is written by McCoy Tyner, who was a pianist with John Coltrane. This is from Farrell Sanders. It's actually a compilation, a 1997 GRP compilation, Priceless Jazz Collection. It's Farrell Sanders on tenor sax, McCoy Tyner on piano, and Roy Haynes on drums. Before that, we heard Stopover Bombay by Alice Coltrane from Journey to Satchitananda. It's a 1970 Impulse release. Alice Coltrane on harp and piano. Farrell Sanders on soprano sax. He plays percussion at times. So, you know, he doesn't just stand still. Tulsi on tambourine, Cecil McBee on bass, Rashid Ali on drums, and Majid Shabazz on bells and tambourine. Before that, we heard a bit of Black Unity. It's like 30-something minutes, that's why you heard a bit. It was a 1963 release on Impulse label, Farrell Sanders recording. Farrell Sanders on tenor sax, Balafone on others. Hannibal Marvin Peterson on trumpet, Carlos Garrett on tenor sax, Joe Bonner on piano, Cecil McBee and Stanley Clark on bass, Norman Connors and Billy Hart on drums, Lawrence Killian on congas and talking drums and xylophone. And before that, we heard another recording from the Sun Ra featuring Farrell Sanders and Black Harold recording that was released in 2009 on the ESP disc. and it was called The Other World. And once again, that's Farrell Sanders on tenor sax, Black Harold, Harold Murray on flute, log drums, Al Evans on trumpet, Teddy Nance on trombone, Marshall Allen on alto sax, Pat Patrick on baritone sax, Alan Silva, Ronnie Boykins on bass, Cliff Jarvis, Jimmy Johnson on drums, and Art Jenkins on space voice. Stay tuned for more Sugar My Bowl on WBAI New York 99.5 FM with me, Joyce Jones, and our discussion with Hank Williams and Joyce Jones's discussion, our discussion with Farrell Sanders. It took place last week at, was it last week? Yeah. Last week when I, Farrell Sanders had a run at Birdland, we visited him in his hotel room and had a great conversation. And a lot of things wound up on the cutting room floor. Stay tuned. Oh, yeah, if you'd like, you can give me a call at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900, or you can email me at sugar, S-U-G-A, in my bowl, at gmail.com if you missed any of the titles. Stay tuned.
You remind me of Randy Weston. You know, when I say, not your playing, because you have your own original voice, definitely. But I tend to think of, and it's probably as a result of being involved with the East in Brooklyn, but I tend to think of, when I think of both you and Randy Weston, I think of the continent of Africa and the villages and, you know, just community and that sort of thing.
Well, that's good, thank you.
What was your experience like when you went to the continent?
Oh, yeah, just feel like my other half is over here. When I look at them, I'm looking at, I'm seeing myself. You know, I said, well, maybe I'm from their tribe. You know, I said, oh, maybe this is where I come from. Maybe from another tribe. I remember when I went to Senegal, one person told me, right away he saw me, he said, Flamalinga. And I said, oh, you know, and he said, oh, you're the right way. They know you're not you're not from over there, you know, but they know where you come from. the roots in that culture, and your looks and your eyes, your cheekbones, and your head. I just left it at that, you know. They treat me with a lot of respect. They really treat artists with a lot of respect. If you're a musician or a painter or something, they have a whole lot of respect for that, what you do. I really enjoyed being over there. I felt like I was at home, you know, and I feel like this is part of me that I've been missing. I never seen mosquitoes bite me that many at one time, you know, and I would say, brother, can I go back in the house? You know, because then they came in the house. I guess they say, well, you're new here, we're going to bite you too. So, you know, but I do go back over there in May. I go to Senegal. They're having a festival over there. So. Well, I went to the restaurants and ate. The guy would come around and play the core at your table while you're eating. And then on the street, on the corners, you see the brother playing the balafon. I said, man, it's music everywhere I go.
recorded with Randy Weston?
Yeah, he let me do one thing with him, only one thing so far.
Okay.
I'm ready for some more, but he let me, he squeezed me in there some kind of way.
Actually, you were on Spirits of Our Ancestors.
Yeah. It's funny, when I come to New York, and I always think about him. I say, where is he at? But Randy's the kind of person, you see him a day, next day, he's gone somewhere. He may be in Africa, maybe, who knows. He just keep moving. And then when I would see him, he said, man, we got to get together. We should do a lot. We should do some things. I said, I'm ready. Are you ready? I'm ready. Just call me when you want to do it. Let's go on and do it. You know, I never hear him talk bad about nobody. He just ran the Western.
I'd actually asked about Spirits because you have this incredible solo on the Gaita.
Now you know, I haven't even heard that record that many times. I heard it a couple of times, and that was it. I feel like I could have did better, at that time, it was okay. Knowing Randy, oh baby, you sound great, oh baby, fell, my man. But I didn't feel that way. I said, okay, all right, Randy, if I can help out, if you like it, okay, Like I said, if Randy called me today and said, hey man, let's do something again, I'm open. Just give me a call. But I can't do it if I'm gone. I'm going to do it while I'm living. Don't get to me quick. You never know when you're going to get off the planet. This here today could be gone tomorrow.
I wanted to ask you about playing at the East.
I feel like that was like Africa when I went over there. That's where I felt. That's where I always feel
way?
When they do. Well, the Spirit.
Let me get you in on this. How'd you? And Farrell Sanders. Well, Mensah Waleed was the bond that brought us together, and we wanted to get Farrell. We were running a school. We were running a cultural center. We were running a information center. That was the East. And we wanted to get Farrell to come and give it his stamp of approval. Mm-hmm. So Mensah said, well, let's go over there and, sit down with him and tell him what's happening. And we did. We went over to his place and we told him what we were doing. And he said, okay. So he said that he would get back to Mensah and set the date. And he did. He got back to Mensah within a couple of weeks, and he set the date. And I don't know how many of you know anything about the East, but the East held about 350 people. That's all that could get into the shrine. And the weekend that Farrell came, it was a 3-day weekend. It was a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And he broke all the attendance records, okay, for the shrine. Friday night, I think he did 3 shows, and it was packed, all 3 shows. And then Saturday night, he did 3 shows, and it was packed the whole time. And then Sunday night, so all the attendance records was broken. We had lines all around the block, and his music just received such a tremendous reception among the various people that came to the East, young people, people in their teens and in their 20s, early 20s, and men and women and handicapped people, and all spiritual people and political people and non-political people, church people. We had pictures of ladies in church, just got out of church on Sunday evening and came to see Farrell. And so it was such a moving experience that when it was over, he told Mensah, he said he'd never seen anything like it. And that was the beginning of our appreciation of the legacy of Farrell Sanders. And then so it was like maybe he'd come there twice a year, 3 times a year, and whenever he came to the East, it became a special event. We would prepare for weeks. Farrell was coming,
And you two, he'd come over my house. Hey, man, I want you to do something with that, I said, I don't want to be too like political, brother, but you are going to be for living. I hate to use that word, you know, but it is there, you know. Y'all know what's going on right now, you know, all that. You know when you're being at the right place, you know, when they accept you, and you don't have to worry about playing, they accept you. Whatever you're going to do, they accept you. That's the respect, you know. So when I go there, I better be playing when I go trucking. They don't like talking bands, and y'all, they like, well, what you gonna do, brother? You know, let's go on and play now. Come on, let's play. Those brothers over there and my sister, they really into the music, and that's kind of like how I got my start, kind of being around them, you know, because I could count on them, you know, being there. You know, it was just that type of energy that I need from the way I play, you know. And a lot of them, they bring their instruments. They come in with their tambourines, their flutes, right, their bells, anything that they feel like that's going to be okay. We know Brother Farrell, he's cool. He'll let us play. So that's cool. So I feel great. I said, that's what it's all about, trying to get as close to the audience, and they'll give you something back, you know. So it's a spiritual kind of thing, you know. I feel like I was in Africa. Well, I don't feel like music is something I have to go to. It's going on right now in this room. And most information has already been told. I've already played. I don't talk that much. I'm trying to talk about what I do. It might take much longer than an hour or something, you know. I feel like I didn't have to play. I just go on and say, hey, everybody, hey, we love you. Yeah, but you got to play, though.
To ask you about playing with Gary Bartz, because it seemed like there was a real intimacy and connection between you two. That I haven't seen between you and other players before.
Well, he was the one of the musicians that I
mean, just to say it was really beautiful and very powerful. So there was something, we weren't exactly sure what was going on, but
we knew each other for a long time, you know, when he first came to New York City, but he always had lived on the West Coast, on the East Coast. Was it like in Baltimore? And I think his parents used to have a club or something, a jazz club at one time. And he raised up in it. But we used to go to the park and play, you know. We used to do some collective things together, you know. He showed me something, I showed him something, you know. That's the way it's been going on. That's, you know, it's been wonderful, you know, all this time, you know. I see him out here cutting up, blowing his horn and playing all over, you know. I think he's been working with the record for a minute or two or something, off and on. Yeah. He's one of those respectable musicians, you know, and we had no problems of communicating, you know. You try to learn as much as you can. If he asked me something, if I knew it, he got it.
We're probably running out of time, but I know you wanted to ask about Bobby Hutcherson.
Yes, I did. You recorded with him on Rejoice. How was it working with Bobby Hutcherson? I mean, had you worked together before you recorded? Have you done dates together? No. Oh.
No, I just always love his playing, you know. When I hear him playing, I know that's him.
Yeah.
Even on radio or whatever, you know. He has a very advanced, he has another concept of playing, I put it that way, you know, which I haven't heard nobody else do the things that he does, you know. And the way he comes out of it, you know, he puts things in place that he wants to put in place, you know. And, but he really writes some good composition, and I really love his music. And he's a good person. You know, he gets kind of funny sometimes. He'd be cracking jokes and all this. So he had me laughing so hard, man. By having me, I'd be about to pass out. I said, Bobby, no more, man, because you give me, I'm gonna have a heart attack with you all these jokes. You know, but he has a lot of humor. He's very good people, you know, and he plays great, and he. Just a great musician. It's hard to find somebody like him, you know. Since I worked with John, you know, I guess she made me feel like I'll bring some kind of joy or something into her music, you know, that she writes, you know, whatever, you know. But most certainly it couldn't have been a John Coltrane. I think she used Joe Henderson also. He did some things, you know, I think she kind of keeps up whatever that legacy is all about, you know, and that and music. Train that came here and John came in, he what he had to do. And that's up to another musician to do the same thing, you know, come on to do your own thing, you know. Speaking of John, you know, playing beside him was about the greatest experience I could really get. Playing with him and standing beside him, I heard things that I never thought of, you know, of doing. Because John had a way of playing and with the breath control, with the kind of breathing that he does some type of rhythmic breathing that I'm still trying to find out how this is done. All of a sudden, it seemed like as you sit next to him, when he starts playing, it's almost like he takes my breath out of my, you know, he makes me feel like I'm trying to breathe correctly as my breathing is going rhythmic with what he's doing. I guess it's just him. You know, how he feels about it, you know. And that kind of approach is, the way he plays, the sound's coming from all kind of like direction. But when he breathes, you know, I already made a run, you know, and when he come down, he may turn into something else. So it's very difficult to really talk about his style of playing, you know. I hear other people trying to, I think just leave that alone. The way John was playing, you know, he was playing like he wasn't going to be here the next day. It sounded like whenever he played, he gave it all up. Every time you hear him. Now, my cause maybe the sound wasn't great or got some problem with the with the electronics, you know, he just played all over that stuff. Matter to him. That's hard to do. I haven't accomplished that yet. I'm still having problems with sound, you know. The mic phone is not right. I don't feel like playing. I've got these issues, you know, that I shouldn't have. I'm trying to be a better, just trying to be a better person, too. So, hopefully that I'll overcome all of it.
Thank you very much, Carol Sandra, for spending this time with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming over.
Well, that was it. That was our exchange with Farrell Sanders. This is Joyce Jones. The closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl, that would be me and Hank Williams. And let's see. This is what you're listening to right now. This is Origins, Farrell Sanders, his recording from his recording Rejoice, 1992 Evidence Records. Art Davis on bass, John Hicks on piano, Billy Higgins on drums, Bobby Hutcherson on vibes, Danny Moore on trumpet, Steve Turay on trombone, Flame Brathwaite, Sakina Muhammad, Yvette S. Vanderpool, and Bobby London, and Carol Wilson Scott on voices. The voices were arranged by William S. Fisher. And let's see, let's do this. We'll go back to Black Unity for a second. And Another Earth was before that by Gary Bartz. Another Earth, the title cut, originally recorded in 1968. This is from a 1998 Milestone Records reissue. It's a twofer, actually, that includes Libra. Reggie Workman on bass, Freddie Watts on drums, Stanley Cowell on drums as well, Farrell Sanders on tenor sax, and Gary Bartz on alto sax, Charles Tolliver on trumpet. And check out the New School. They have a recital thing going on in May. Randy Workman is the director of the jazz program over there. So check it out. They have a lot of recitals coming up, including one that focuses on John Coltrane. And before that, we heard Blue Moses, arranged by the recording Spirits of Our Ancestors, is arranged by Melba Liston. That was Randy Weston. 1992 Antilles release, Randy Weston on piano, Farrell Sanders on gaita, Alex Blake on and Jamil Nasir on bass, Idris Muhammad on drums, Big Black on percussion for those who saw Soul Power. That was the one who did the percussion solo there. Yasir Chadley and Azadine Weston on Karkaba, excuse me. And let's see, I think that's it. Stay tuned for Mass Backwards, Max Schmid. Coming up next, Max Schmid and Mass Backwards. And we'll see you next month on Sugar in My Bowl, the third Tuesday. You can email me at sugar, S-U-G-A, in my bowl, at gmail.com. Stay tuned for more on WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
Hello? Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.